Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, friends, to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Marvin Gowron, Chuck Thurston, and Andre Rodatis. Hi, you guys.
Hey,
Paula, you're back.
Welcome
We're all back. Yay. I know. I missed you guys. Studying with you is really such a pleasure and such a thrill for me, and just makes my whole week. And study group has long done that for me, but this is even better than most study groups I've ever attended. Maybe it's because it's just the four of us for the most part. I don't know. It's just really remarkable. So thank you, my friends.
I think each grouping of human beings is a minor miracle. I mean, it's a unique configuration of persons and personalities. And it's, you know, it's really interesting. I mean, we really missed having a woman, a female presence, you know, just to have the androgyny of the mixture of sharing. But there's something about, you know, I think all four of us are very long-term students. We're very dedicated students of the revelation, and the things that concern all four of us, we share many of them in common, I think. And so I think to a degree that I haven't experienced in any other study group, and you know, we're both, all four of us are pretty gabby. we have no shortage of things that we'd like to share. And I think the result of all of that is that we really stimulate each other's thinking and communicate very easily and effectively to a degree that's rather unusual for any group of four people. And so the result is actually a very satisfying interaction of the four of us with the text. So I agree with you, Paul. I've never experienced the enjoyable nature and the depth of study that I have with the three of you. So it's a real treat.
Well, thank you. I absolutely concur. Chuck, were you going to say something?
Yeah, no, it's just that. I think we all feel the same way.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah,
chemistry, I guess. I don't know. But, you know,
I think it is. I'm hoping that it's a treat for our listeners. That they get to sort of partake and share, and on occasion share their thoughts, but to ricochet with our insights on the text. Yeah, it's really fun.
Well, it's a treat for us. You know, it's a treat for me for sure, and I know I assume that it is for you guys, or you wouldn't still be here. So, you know, that really says a lot. And, you know, it's just wonderful to have so much in common with human beings. And it's mm-hmm. and it's an unusual commonality. You know, we share a love for this thing that claims to be an epical revelation on our planet. And what's so unique about that for me is that each one of us came to it in our own way, and each reader we ever meet and talk to would say the same thing. Each one comes to it in a very unique way as a combination of a search for something. And, you know, I've heard so many stories about, quote, how I found the Urantia book, you know, from so many different wonderful human beings that I've met in my association with this thing. And the story is so similar in that it started with a search and a hunger. It starts with a hunger for more. And many have expressed, and I know I share this feeling too, that they just knew there was something more. They just knew it. And so they were searching, actively searching for that something more. And, you know, and they found it.
Without even
knowing
what they're searching
for. Yeah, in some cases, they didn't even know what they were searching for, but they just knew there has to be more. And you look back on your life and you can see how it's punctuated with these, you know, feelings about this, that there just has to be more. And I'm going to find it. You know, there's a truth out there, to coin the X-Files great statement, you know, the truth is out there. We just knew there was a truth out there and we found it. And, you know, I like to point out to people that we're unique in that we found each other. And most of us found each other by writing to the publisher of the book. And I often ask, you know, when I've done an introduction, I often ask the group that I'm introducing to the Urantia book, how many books do you have at home on your bookshelf where it occurs to you to write the publisher to see who else reads it?
Right.
And they that's the response. You know, they think about it for a second and go, none, you know. And yet we all did that. Every single one of us reached out to the publisher of the Urantia book to say, I can't be the only one reading this thing. There's got to be others. Mm-hmm. Please tell me where they are.
Yeah. Well, part of that, at least for me, is just that there's almost nothing more fun than reading and talking about the Urantia book. And that, you know, that requires at least two people to do that. And you can read it by yourself, of course, but the experience of reading it together with one or more people and then talking about it as you're reading it, I mean, that's just, I don't know, I just think that that's just such a delightful experience. I've never been disappointed just because of what it opens up in terms of not only one's own understanding, but also feeling like there's building a common ground, of understanding that we can all stand on together. And that's given the scope of the reality frame of the Urantia book, that's something significant. But it,
well, you know,
at least for me, it like tickles my soul. You know, it's like, yeah, I want more of that.
Give me more of that.
There's another factor too. I mean, you mentioned the hunger. I as I remember it, Paula, and it grew quite pointed several weeks before I actually encountered the text, which is interesting. It'd be fun to compare notes a little bit. But the way I've described it is there was a tremendous sense of emptiness or a huge question mark inside of me as to what reality was and what was going on in this life and in reality in the universe. What is this all about? You know, what's it all about, Alfie? You know, that sort of existential question. And that desire to know, to understand what I was part of and how I could live effectively to contribute to it and be part of it was quite acute for several weeks and months before I found the book. And the other factor I was going to say is, and I'm curious, I know, Paula, this is true for you, and I know it's true for Andre. We had some conversation here over the last few days when we were visiting together, that the three of us, and I don't know enough about your history, Chuck, but I suspect it's similar, found the book when we were in really late adolescence, or they were right thereabouts. And I'm curious, Chuck, how old you were when you encountered the text.
Early 20s.
Yeah, very, very similar.
Yeah, I was 20.
And
yeah,
I was a post non-graduate.
Yeah.
And Andre and I compared notes. We were both 17 when we found the text.
Oh, okay.
But it's very similar period developmentally. And I think there is something about spending your entire adult life developmentally immersed in the perspectives, the culture of this revelation, and be, you know, sort of as a budding universe citizen, and then to spend all of your mature adult functioning life in that context is very shaping. I think it has shaped who we are, how we think and feel and interact with each other and move through life in a big way. And so, I mean, to have encountered it, all four of us to have encountered it so early in our lives and have lived our lives in that context and studying it all the way along is part of the chemistry, I think. Because I'm a hugely different person as a result of that. I have no clue what I might have been like if I had not had the arrangement.
That's the point.
Yeah, Michael, I think we could all say that as well.
Yeah.
And part of what's so interesting about that, I think, is that kind of growth, that undeniable growth and development that you're talking about is part of the reality test of the book as a revelation, I think. The fact that it functions that way, that you can live it in that sense, that it really does have that kind of a shaping and formative influence, to me, speaks to its connection to reality, because it wouldn't have that. It wouldn't function that way otherwise. So even though the Erasmus book talks about all kinds of things way beyond the scope of just, you know, ordinary human knowledge, all of that begins to fall into place in such a way that you realize, wow, this is I'm exploring a more complete understanding of reality here, and that does change it. But the fact that can happen so consistently and so joyfully and welcome in such a welcome way, to me, speaks to the reality of what it is, that it wouldn't function that way if it wasn't what it says it is. I don't know if you've had that feeling too, but
without a doubt.
So it's kind of a confirmation in that reality testing process that we all go through. I mean, maybe you were all, I mean, I was, you know, reasonably skeptical at first, of course, and maybe still am in some ways, but nonetheless, you drink from the well when you find the well. You don't like walk away. So.
Yeah. I think if I hadn't prayed so hard for it, and I didn't even know what I was praying for necessarily, but, you know, there was some key decisions I made, and I was reading recently about the circles, you know, the psychic circles of attainment. And one of the decisions I made was I told God, you know, I rejected a fundamental dogmatic religion of authority, rejected it completely because it said things about God that I didn't believe in my heart. And I said, that's not
right.
My God. And I told God, you know, you're going to have to reveal yourself to me because I'm not getting involved with any more religions. And, you know, I think about young people who make that declaration, you know. They say, it's not this. And maybe they don't know that there's something else, you know, and so maybe they just throw everything out, you know, because it just, none of it makes any sense. But I knew the reality of God, and so I told him, you know, this is not the you I know, and but you're going to have to reveal yourself to me because I'm not getting involved with any more religions. And then 4 years later, my dad died, and I prayed very fervently that God would show me where my dad was and that he still was. And within, you know, and I mean, it was gut-wrenching soul, you know, prayer, you know, make no delay, my Lord, you know, give this to me now. I need to know. And within days, this book was in my hands. And, you know, if I were to have said, well, that's just a coincidence, you know, Yeah, Jesus said, if you seek, you'll find, and if you ask, you'll be answered, and if you knock, the door will be open. Yeah, he said all of that, but this is just a coincidence that this book just so happens to be in my hands right now after I said that prayer to God and cried myself asleep, you know? What's the chance?
Yeah.
And, no, far from that. It was more of a complete soul affirmation. This is what you've been waiting for. This is what you've been looking for. And I felt more compelled to read it than anything I've ever felt compelled to do. And so, of course, I did, because I knew it was the answer to my prayer. I just knew.
Well, let me ask you a question, because I remember this so distinctly. I mean, I can close my eyes and I'm back there. Right. And that was the moment that you first laid eyes and had interaction with the text, what your reaction was, because I know mine. I mean, it was like, it was immediate. I mean, I didn't know, you're right, Paul. I couldn't know what I had just encountered, because the knowledge of it comes from actually getting the context from the revelation itself to understand what it is as a phenomenon. But I had profound is not the right word. From the top to the bottom, all of my being said, this thing is different, and this is maybe what you've been looking for. And it was like I could feel it almost physically, but certainly intellectually, a sense of recognition that was almost visceral. And I'm curious if when you first encountered the text, if you felt its unusual nature and its significance.
Well, I did. I saw three things. And, you know, it's interesting that we say, you know, we have experiences in our life that we never forget. Yes, of course we do. And encounters with people that we never forget. And, you know, but prayers that we said that we never forget. And equally interesting are thoughts that we had, thoughts that we never forget. And I thought three things in my first encounter with the Urantia book. I was reading Birth and Infancy and reading about Joseph and Mary. My experience with this other fundamental group of religionists, they're very much Bible-oriented. And so I had a fairly decent knowledge of the Bible at that point. And I remember thinking three things I thought, you know, because the detail was just superb. And I thought, this isn't in the Bible. And then I thought, who would pretend to know this? And then I thought, if they would pretend to know it, why? Why would they?
Mm-hmm.
What's the point?
What's
and
the motivation?
I immediately said, I need to read this book. That was my fourth thought. I need to read this book. But I said it out loud. And my husband said, yes, you do. And my first husband, Bob Tomer, said, yes, you do. You take it with you. Because I had purchased it for him. You know, I know now that Spirit used him as a conduit to get it to me. I was the one that was supposed to read it. And he was not at all interested in it after that point. He asked me for it, but after that point, when he delivered it to me, he had no interest in it whatsoever. He wouldn't even let me read it to him. You know, I'd say, oh, God, Bob, you have to hear this. This is just so exquisitely beautiful. Or I don't want to hear that. Okay. But yeah, three thoughts I had, I'll never forget as long as I live, and that, you know, I'm hoping that's forever. You know, that's the goal.
Yeah. Yeah, something very similar. Yeah, go ahead, Chuck.
Oh, I was going to say, I just remember being very, very curious about God. You know, what was up with this God thing, right? Because, I don't know, you know, it's sort of sorting out all the, you know, materialist atheist thinking, which I was pretty indoctrinated with. And then the whole, like, the religious presentations, always wanted you to, like, join their church or whatever. And I don't know, I was just sort of swimming in confusion about what God was about. I had this experience with hanging out with some friends where I heard somebody talking about, it was the first time in my life that I experienced this. I heard somebody talking about God outside of religion, just as a reality. You know, just talking about God as a reality, you know, like the wind or the rain or whatever. And I was like, whoa, maybe there's something there. You know, that was like a kind of a mind opening. Yeah, that sounds kind of silly now, but at the time it was kind of significant. And
not
then
at all.
It wasn't maybe more than, I don't know how much time passed, but not very much time. Somebody was showing me the Rancho book, and in the very first paragraph of the foreword, it says, in the minds of the mortals of your Rancho, that being the name of your world, there exists great confusion respecting the meaning of such terms as God, divinity, and deity.
Right.
Human beings are still more confused and uncertain about the relationships of the divine personalities designated by these numerous appellations. Because of this conceptual poverty associated with so much ideational confusion, I have been directed to formulate this introductory statement in explanation of the meanings which should be attached to certain word symbols as they may be hereinafter used in those papers which the Orvantine Corps of Truth Revealers have been authorized to translate into the English language of Urantia. And that was it. I was done.
That was, you were toast, huh?
Yeah, right. It was like, okay, sign me up. But that real thing about Orvantine Corps of Truth Revealers is like, ooh, what is that? But anyway,
well,
the authoritative tone that's going to tell me
that's it.
God in reality was what I was so hungering for.
Right.
And then, of course, everything else follows from that.
That authoritative tone.
Yeah, well, and I remember distinctly two things. One, right after I got the book, I was 17, you know, so I was living with my parents, and I didn't crack it open. I didn't want to crack it open for about 3 days. I just kept it in my room, and I waited for a time when my family, my mom and dad and my sister, were both all out of the house, predictably for about 2 or 3 hours, because I did not want to be disturbed. And I sat down in my favorite reclining chair where I would read stuff like, you know, Alan Watts and P.D. Ouspensky and other metaphysical stuff. And I remember holding the book with my two hands before I opened it up. And I said to myself, now I am going to begin. And it was such a I had no idea what the thing was, because I had seen was the table of contents. But I had such a profound sense of commencement, of beginning something that had a huge portent to it. And then the other time I remember and the thought, it came about 2 months later, after I'd read enough of it, really get the conception of what the authors were claiming this text was. You know, I understood enough to know what an epical revelation was, you know, and who the authors were, and what they were claiming this book was as a phenomenon pretty fully. And I had been having this experience for a few weeks of, the only way I can describe it is having my mind stretched, almost like physically, you know, like it was expanding frames of reference. And I remember saying to myself, you know, I believe that this is what they claim it is. Mm. I really believe it because it, even that early on, it was beyond my conception of any human group of human beings to author anything like this. And I remember that moment where I said to myself, I accept this. I accept this as ethical revelation from higher celestial beings to our world. And I was just like, physically, it almost sent chills over me to realize the import of that for me and for my life. You know, it's just like it was almost physical. But I'd love to hear Andre. You know, Andre's been quiet.
Me,
I don't know if he's
me too. I want to add one thing to that, though, Marvin. I want to add that, you know, I like to tell people it's the greatest evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence ever. I mean, it's the greatest evidence on this planet of extraterrestrial intelligence. But you just have to read it to see if you agree with that. But that's the way I would characterize it. If you didn't believe that there was otherworldly, highly spiritual and intelligent beings before you read the Urantia book, you would darn sure believe it after you were done reading. But Andre,
just that it's not only vertical, not only vertically more intelligent, but horizontally. Not only are there more inhabited worlds like our own, but they're just as much horizontally, there are higher and higher celestial intelligences, many, many orders of them, which is a whole other dimension of depth to it. So, Yeah, Andre, go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's similar to everybody else. I think the thing that's common in all of our stories is that we were all searching. And I'd always been curious about all kinds of things when I was a kid. And I definitely paid attention in church to everything that people were saying. By the time I was 13, I was kind of tired of the priests always saying, you know, every second Sunday, the most important part of the sermon was, now remember to put something into the collection plate, and how important that was. And you know, I get that, but it seemed that there were lost opportunities. And I was searching and searching, and by the time I was, 16, I had a lot of questions, and I was looking and saying, you know, well, what can I do to improve my prayer life? And I heard about transcendental meditation. So shortly, about halfway through after my 17th birthday, I went and paid my $60 and got the training in transcendental meditation and got my mantra and started practicing that. And within about a month, you know, at exactly that same time, I was introduced to a friend in high school, and we got to talking about philosophical issues, and we would talk on our way home. And about a month later, and it was in about the middle of the month of March, I always remember it's my anniversary month, and he said, you know, my brother has this book that claims to be written by angels. I said, oh, yeah? And I followed him home. And I went down to Jack Nuremberg's basement, and he showed me the book with the white dust jacket, and I just stared at the white dust jacket and read it and said, the central and super universes, the local universe, the history of Urantia, the life and teachings of Jesus. Who would put these four ideas together, first of all? You know, so that had me puzzled. So I opened it up and looked at the table of contents and read down there and read the abbreviated table of contents, titles of the papers it's called, right, with the authors there. And yeah, I've told this story many times, looking through Divine Counselor, Perfector of Wisdom, Universal Censor, Mighty Messenger, And the next thought for me was, they may as well have said Mighty Mouse. Who's going to believe this? You know, what kind of names are those? You know, and then my next thought was, oh, maybe they don't care if that's all it takes to get you to put the book down. Well, I thought, oh, maybe it's a filter. So I started looking at what it was talking about, and I found it fascinating, you know, Adam and Eve and central and super universe stuff, you know, central universe, sacred spheres of paradise, go down the history of Urantia, origin of life, all this kind of stuff that was there. And I asked my friend to be able to borrow it and take it home. And he loaned it to me, and I just started reading. And I can't count the number of times that I was laying in bed holding the book above my head, and it fell on my face because I fell asleep reading it. You know,
good sleeping.
Yeah.
Yeah. You sleep really soundly.
That was it. It was love at first sight.
Yeah.
You know, there was that idea of, I mean, there was an inner knowing, and it was very, I won't call it subconscious. I don't know whether it was superconscious, but it was in the background. It was there almost saying, wow, this seems to be the real article.
Yeah.
And so I said I would read, you know, I told myself I would read it with an artificially skeptical attitude because I knew I was prone to not being naive or gullible exactly, but trusting. You know, our society, being as cynical as it is, you know, tends to view people that are easy believers or trusting as pejoratively naive or gullible. And, well, that's true in a highly cynical society. It's not a great survival skill. But you can imagine on a normal world, that probably functions very, very well. You know, if people give you good information, then being ready to receive it is a trait to have. And, you know, I count myself lucky to have not been made cynical at an early age, and to have always been curious. I mean, I was somebody who sat down in the library aisles or opened the dictionary and started reading. You know, that's the kind of guy I was. So anyway, that's
okay,
my
so
story.
I've heard
sticking to it.
Over such a great story, too. I love that. You remembered exactly what you thought, too. You might as well have said Mighty Mouse. You know, I've heard a lot of stories over the years, amazing stories, wonderful stories, but I want to share just one, just briefly, because it's somebody we all know and love and respect, who many years ago, and he's gone now, so I feel like I can say this, it doesn't betray his confidence, and I don't think that it was a secret. I think he would have told anybody this if they'd have asked him, but it was Mr. Charles Olivier. And we were talking about how we found the Urantia book. And he told me, he said, and I highly recommend, friends, if you haven't heard some of the shows that we did with Charles, they were wonderful. Charles was a guest on our show many times. He came on to talk about angels.
Yeah.
He came on, you know, to talk about history. And it was always a delight to have Charles on the show. Such a thoughtful you know, man of integrity. He's just an amazing man. And he told me that he was a young man also, maybe 20, and he was just on the verge of his life, and he felt the import of decisions he was making. Deeply, deeply spiritual man. Always. You get the sense that he was always had a deep spiritual nature in his life. And he was praying, and he had two books in front of him. Gary will appreciate this. Shout out to Gary on the Port, because he can relate to this experience somewhat. he had two books in front of him, and one was the Arantia book, and one was, I wish I could remember what the other book was. It was another really thick book of heavy import, you know, but I just can't remember which book it was. And he was praying to God and the universe and the angels, which one should I read? Which one should I read? And I think he must have known that either one was a big commitment. And he said, two midwayers walked through the wall and tapped on the Arantia book. Read this one. Now, if it wasn't Charles Olivier, nobody would believe it. And it goes to your, you know, your point, Andre, about skepticism. I don't know if I should believe that or not. But a man as serious and as straightforward and as honest and as full of integrity as Charles, to say that, I absolutely believe that's exactly what happened. And it isn't the only time I've heard an extraordinary story like that. You know, and lots of times you go, well, I don't know. but Charles, you know, and so we know they're real. We know they act in our lives. We know they care deeply about us. We know that there's something going on this planet right now at this time and has been for a few hundred years, I'll say. You know, we're heading to a new level. It's just like they tell us in many, many ways. We're on the brink. We're at the crossroads of a momentous decision. We're moving forward. The ship is steamed out of the harbor, right? They say it in so many ways. But this is like a crossroads for humanity. And this book is here strategically. It's here for a reason. And for those of us who look for it, you know, if we're sincere in that search, we will find it. It will come into our lives one way or another. I have faith in that. I believe that. And I think that I would have found it. If I didn't find it then, I would have found it at another time in another way. But it would have kept coming up for me. I just know that. So.
Well, you know, I'll, what was that, you, Andre? I'll share another story. It's sort of related. And then I'll try and share another thought, and I'll try to be succinct because it's a sort of a full-bodied thought. The story is...
And it's almost time to read.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So, well, we're getting close to 40 minutes, and...
You
average.
Take the last thought on this, and then we'll start reading. Right, and perfectly apropos that we would read Faith and Belief, right, after this discussion. So,
yeah. So you were telling stories. The first study group I was part of was with Franthel and I. This is back in, 1970s, sometime, anyways. Franthel and I and Rich Keeler. Rich Keeler lived in Solana Beach at that time. He had a beautiful little condo overlooking the ocean. And we were in San Diego. I was in graduate school. And we would get together at his place. And the one other person, it was a very small study group, was a fellow named Mark Freeman. And he was a really interesting guy. So we were all, you know, Francis and I were in our late 20s, and Rich was probably in his later 30s. He was older. Mark was like in his late 60s. So he was an older guy, white hair, I remember, very handsome fellow. And he was a Jehovah's Witness, lifelong Jehovah's Witness. And it was very high up in the Jehovah's Witness infrastructure. He actually was the editor-in-chief of, their main publication.
Watchtower, yeah.
Watchtower, yeah. And so he was one of the, you know, the top 10 leaders in Jehovah's Witness culture. And he found the Arantia book. And he was a writer, you know, he wrote for them. And he made it his mission to debunk the Arantia book. And so he, you know, you talk about motivation. He recognized it as something unusual. And he said, every page I turned, he read it from front to back, I was looking for what I could use to invalidate its claims. And he said he read every page carefully, looking for that information. He got to the last page of the book, closed the back cover, and he said, "This thing is true." he could not find it, and that's how he became and he left. You know, he had to back out of his participation in Jehovah's Witnesses, but he was a wonderful, sweet, and very intelligent guy. And so there's another story of someone who read it from front to back with the intent to invalidate it and could not do it and reach the conclusion it was what it claimed to be. So I love that story. Mark was a dear friend, passed on to the Mansion Worlds quite a long time ago. I'll share one other thing, and I'll try, I don't know if I can say this succinctly. I'll try. I've been getting ready to do a workshop this summer's fellowship gathering. I'm still looking for a title for it, but it's something along the lines of, a triune revelation, you know, the Melchizedek, Jesus, and the Urantia revelation as a planned triple whammy. Triune revelatory stimulus that was designed to be unfolded in three parts. And there are a lot of implications for that. You think about, you know, talking about our moment in history, Paula, you think about what Melchizedek's missionaries accomplished. They basically laid the foundation for every system of religious symbolic culture that is extant on the planet today. They established the basis for a combination in the West of Judaism, Christianity, and then later on Islam, and everything that flows from those three fundamental monotheistic faiths. They spread out and they established the basis for the Eastern religions, right? So it's Hinduism had already existed. There were before they spread out, there were the Aboriginal religious systems, cultures. There was the Australian Aboriginal, the Red Man in North and South America, their religious culture, and the Hindu culture was also pre-existing. But the Melchizedeks uplifted Hinduism through the Brahmanics culture, and then they, in the Axial Age, you know, the 6th century B.C., what the Salem missionaries did was they stimulated the founding of Buddhism. The Hinduism was uplifted. They founded Buddhism. And then later Taoism and Confucianism. So they stimulated all of those religions. And then the other major religious culture in response that happened, you know, at the turn of the 1800s, was Marxist atheistic secularism, which the book describes as secular totalitarianism. And it is a genuine religious system. You know, it's a symbolic set of systematic beliefs that shape a person's worldview. And they tend to recap the earlier forms of human leader worship. So you've got things like, Marx and Lenin, and then latterly Stalin, and now Vladimir Putin. In China, you had Mao Zedong, Dao Zedong, and then now Xi. These are all like emperor, like Roman emperor figures. They're human deity slash figures in an atheistic system. And those two philosophic religious systems are, I won't shrink from saying, they're Luciferian religions. They're basically virulently atheistic, based on the premise that humanity is the highest reality there is. And they adulate human semi-deity figures who have both sort of cultural and political soul power. They're totalitarian. So you have in the modern day you have all of these symbolic cultural systems, spiritual systems, religious systems that are have their own symbolisms and traditions and rituals, and that is the culture we find. That is the global emerging culture we find ourselves in today, right? And it's the legacy of the Melchizedek missionaries, plus developments since that time, and into that mix comes this fifth epical revelation, which is the explication of Jesus' fourth bestowal in full detail, plus all of the universe context for it. And it absolutely is as a potential symbolic spiritual culture based on spiritual family relationships. You know, it's all about relationships, persons, and spiritual family that is the core symbolism. It has the potential to come into and disrupt and overlay on all of these religious cultures globally as they're evolving, you know, in the next several hundred years. And we in the Urantia movement have a tremendous opportunity to become a cultural stimulus, a symbolic cultural stimulus, using the tool of this revelation. But in my mind, make no mistake, this fifth ethical revelation is the culmination of the Melchizedek and the Jesus bestowal endeavor. It's a full explication of what those previous revelations set out to accomplish. And of course, Jesus bestowal is the crown jewel, you know.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. So anyways, it's just...
And it's,
when you think about...
It's the one part of the book that can stand alone, really. That stand almost completely alone.
Well, but
the, Jesus
but the other... But the other three parts vastly... enlarge the revelation of part four, vastly, in a universe frame, both outwardly and also inwardly in terms of the nature of the interior life and the nature of soul and thought adjuster, etc. So anyways, it's when you look at the current world situation with that sense of legacy and what's going on in all the different parts of it, you know, we have to accomplish the eventual death throes of Luciferian religion, you know, that says there is no God and we are the highest thing, and the leaders are basically very self-aggrandizing and totalitarian. And we have those elements in our own culture as well, you know.
Well, religious leaders have done the same thing, elevating themselves to their level of importance, which is not correct. And not right.
Yeah.
God alone is sovereign, and that's one of the messages of the Urantia book, clearly, that needs to be learned by humanity. But, you know, with that, let's start reading. Should I read Faith and Belief, you guys?
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely.
Okay, so this is paper 101, The Real Nature of Religion, section 8, Faith and Belief. Belief has attained the level of faith when it motivates life and shapes the mode of living. The acceptance of a teaching as true is not faith. That is mere belief. Neither is certainty nor conviction faith. A state of mind attains to faith levels only when it actually dominates the mode of living. Faith is a living attribute of genuine personal religious experience. One believes truth, admires beauty, and references goodness, but does not worship them. Such an attitude of saving faith is centered on God alone, who is all of these personified and infinitely more. Belief is always limiting and binding, banding and releasing. Belief fixates. Faith liberates. But living religious faith is more than the association of noble beliefs. It is more than an exalted system of philosophy. It is a living experience concerned with spiritual meanings, divine ideals, and supreme values. It is God-knowing and man serving. Beliefs may become group possessions, but faith must be personal. Theologic beliefs can be suggested to a group, but faith can rise up only in the heart of the individual religionist. Faith has falsified its trust when it presumes to deny realities and to confer upon its devotees assumed knowledge. Faith is a traitor when it fosters betrayal of intellectual integrity and belittles loyalty to supreme values and divine ideals. Faith never shuns the problem-solving duty of mortal living. Living faith does not foster bigotry, persecution, or intolerance, does not shackle the creative imagination. Neither does it maintain an unreasoning prejudice toward the discoveries of scientific investigation. Faith vitalizes religion and constrains the religionist heroically to live the golden rule. The zeal of faith is according to knowledge, and its strivings are the preludes to sublime peace. That's got to be one of the most poetic sections of the whole book. It's so, so beautiful.
Yeah, it's a wonderful contrastive kind of construction, you know, where it goes through the back and forth there. Belief fixes,
yeah.
Faith liberates, and so on. And it's just beautiful how it seeks to deliver what it regards as the more important concept by contrasting it with the less important one.
Would you say that faith starts with belief, that belief evolves into faith? Or is faith something had regardless of what you believe?
Yeah, more the latter in a certain sense. I mean, good beliefs can bolster and foster and provide a good grounding for faith. But, you know, if a person is motivated to do the right thing, regardless of what they believe, then that would tend to indicate faith as a separate reality entirely, something that acts. If there are beliefs operating in faith, they can be quite unconscious. They don't have to be the things that are held in the conscious mind. So, yeah, it's very, very interesting how that operates. And you know what you have faith in by how you're acting. That's easy. You know, you can talk a great game. You can pay lip service to anything. But the proof is in the pudding. The proof is in exactly how you're behaving and what you're spending your time on, what you're doing.
Well, we know, you know, in other places they talk about how our thoughts lead us Godward, but they never say that our thoughts are God. But we, you know, the mind has to be willing to accept something, to be able to categorize it somehow, or to be able to recognize it in order to be open to the experience. But faith, the way they're talking about it, is more about the experience than whatever the intellectual frame might be for that experience. It's interesting how they position faith as emerging in the heart.
Yes.
I think that's a really key aspect. So it's, you know, you can believe all kinds of things, but what do you really hold in your heart? And that seems to be more what faith is about, because that's what really then is going to guide your evaluations, you know, to bring spirit into your mind, to shine the light of spirit on your beliefs, maybe. But there has to be that other, well, they say it's not even a conviction. But I was going to say conviction, but it's, you know, they're saying it's even more than that it actually dominates the mode of living. So that's a big clue, I think.
They said that twice, too, I think, or more.
Yeah, I
agree. That it dominates the mode.
Well, and I think there are a number of strands, actually, in the text that kind of distinguish. You know, we've got material minds down here, and that's the apparatus with which we think. So we conceptualize or conceive of something with our minds. But I think you're 100% right, and everyone's been saying the same thing. The thing about faith is that there's a truth component, and what's also associated inseparably from truth is they say it must be lived out. It must be actually embodied in living experience, meaning relationships, decisions, things we do in life, not just think about. And what they sort of imply is that when we enter that realm of action and acting on what we believe, basing our lives on it, then we're in what they term the Marantia realm. Marantia seems to be associated with inseparably with living experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was
to think about.
I was struck by an earlier quote from section 6 about morality, and it says, this is from the same paper, 101, 6.3, moral will embraces decisions based on reasoned knowledge, augmented by wisdom, and sanctioned by religious faith. Such choices are acts of moral nature and evidence the existence of moral personality, the forerunner of Marantia personality, and eventually of true spirit status. I think that in a sense also is the mode of living, right? That's where it meets the road. And we know from, you know, there's another place in the book that says the moral decision, the first moral decision constitutes the first religious experience. So it's interesting how that's so tied to morality. And I'm intrigued by that. I'm very much intrigued by that. Just the mode of living. And the thing about what we just read that really, you know, struck me is they tell us theologic beliefs can be suggested to a group, but faith can rise up only in the heart of the individual religionist, just as you were saying, Chuck. Mm-hmm. And then they go on to say, you know, and I get a kind of a however, faith, after it has risen up in your, you know, heart, has falsified its trust when it presumes to deny realities and to confer upon its devotees assumed knowledge. Faith is a traitor when it fosters the betrayal of intellectual integrity and belittles loyalty to supreme values and divine ideals. The reason that struck me is because, you know, I would have thought they were talking about belief, not faith in that instance. It's like they just gave us the real definition of faith, and now they're telling us that faith, that, but even by that definition, faith can falsify its trust when it presumes to deny realities and confer upon its devotees assumed knowledge. I just wondered what you guys think about that.
Yeah. Well, they're kind of, without saying it, they're, you know, maybe talking a little bit about like when faith becomes fanatical. I hate to use that word, but you know what I mean? When that thing that comes up in the heart, yes, but then it like spills over and begins to corrupt the intellectual level with, you know, these things they're talking about, assumed knowledge and betrayal of intellectual integrity. So the answer book, and the way it always does, is talking about a balance here, I think, that your faith that motivates you from your heart has to be understood within the mind as well, not just counting the importance of the intellectual integrity. So intellectual integrity involves seeing reality for what it is, and not just automatically assuming that, I don't know what would be an example of what they're talking about here, but we could probably think of many. You know, a lot of the strange beliefs that are associated with religions would probably fall into this category of assumed knowledge, right?
Yeah, right.
I don't know. You know, like a lot of the stuff and things like that, where people just assume that this whole end time scenario is going to happen. How do they know that? They don't know that. Somebody just made that up, right? But they take it as assumed knowledge.
Yeah, that would be a great. Be a great example.
That is, that's a good example.
The other kind of example that I've seen was, and I don't mean to offend anybody of any particular faith here, but one of the ugliest things I ever saw was at a celebration around, you know, the holiday season around Christmas time. In a particular faith, and I'm not even going to name the faith because I really don't intend to disparage it, but this still struck me as terribly ugly. And what happened during that ceremony was there was a rare communion service in this faith. They rarely did that. And what they did was they passed around a chalice of wine or a cup of wine along with the bread, and the assumed knowledge, right? The assumption was that only those that were going to rise up in the next life should partake. And so here's this communion service where everyone is passing the cup to the next person and watching to see if anybody is going to take a drink of that cup in order to see whether or not they're making that assumption about themselves, or they have that faith realization about themselves, whatever it might be in the mind of the perceiver. But to me, it seemed like such a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of situation. And it was so anti in the spirit of communion. And we've actually have one of our friends who described going through this service because she had been part of this faith.
Mm-hmm.
And she drank of the cup. And, she didn't drink of it because there was any grand presumption or whatever. It was a matter of she believed in the love of God. That was what was actuating her. And the vituperation that she got from her congregation was unconscionable. But to me, that's an indication that's one of the clearest indication of this, of an illustration of assumed knowledge. And there's so many things like that. I mean, we see it over and over and over again in the life and teachings of Jesus, where the Pharisees and Sadducees were bringing up their basically Talmudic rules and decrying what Jesus or his apostles were doing because of their assumption of what was important in living a religious life. And Jesus was having to point out over and over again how they missed the grand truths. The commandments were trumped by their belief in their traditions. Their traditions of doing one thing would actually triumph over what was a more moral commandment. And that's, I think, part of what they're referring to as well.
Yeah, okay. So in a sense, they're saying that, you know, you can have this faith that rises up in your heart as an individual believer, maybe because theologic beliefs have been suggested to your group, and that grows and ripens into a faith. But that faith can be falsified. That faith has falsified its trust when it presumes to deny the realities and to confirm upon its devotees' assumed knowledge. And it is a traitor when it fosters betrayal of intellectual integrity and belittles loyalty to supreme values and divine ideals. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that makes total sense then.
Well, there's a breathing element.
One of the biggest ones, of course, is a supreme value and divine ideal is, right. You know, the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. If you're treating people less than your fellows and your brothers and your sisters, if you're doing that, you know, in the name of a religion, right? If you're doing it in the name of a belief, if you're doing it in the name of political principle, you know, any number of things like that, you're behaving falsely. You're denying a higher reality in order to invoke something that you have disproportionately elevated to be a false supreme value. And this is what happens, you know, when you have, you know, literal supremacist movements, you know,
right.
Where one group is supreme over another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just going to point out, too, that, you know, we've all noticed when the Urantia book talks about religion, that there are kind of two different versions of that, or two categories.
Yeah.
And there's institutional religion, and then there's personal religion. And
right.
I think the same applies here with faith. So like in the sentence where it says, faith has falsified its trust when it presumes to deny realities and to confer upon its devotees assumed knowledge. That sounds like an institutional faith. You know,
right,
sometimes
a good thing.
The word faith is even used to refer to a, you know, established religion. You know, oh, what's your faith? Oh, I'm a Christian, I'm a Hindu or whatever. And that's kind of a different meaning of the word, really, compared to what they're talking about here as a personal experience, as an individual, conviction. But anyway,
well, it's
discovery,
kind of contrasting
say,
it, isn't it, Chuck?
Of an organizing principle that motivates you in a way that nothing else can, which is loyalty to God, you know, discovering you have a personal relationship with God. That's at the heart,
right.
You know, the heart of the heart of all of this is that. And that's very different from just signing up and paying your dues or something with an organized group. Not to say there can't be value in that too, but the terminology kind of gets, you know, spread over too many different meanings sometimes, which can make
things confusing. Maybe not. I mean, what they're talking about is how faith can be vitiated by putting your faith into lesser values. You know, it's still, in a certain sense, faith. You know, when you have faith, for instance, in the almighty dollar, and you live your life according to that, well, that surely is not religious faith according to what we would call a true religious faith, but it is idolatry. And it does have an effect on a person because it's effectively faith in a false spiritual value. Somebody who's not, you know, having faith in the materiality of money, they're having faith in something that is a false spiritual value of the importance and treasure in one's own life.
Right.
And
it's kind of like they're
living that way will lead to a crash at some point.
Mm.
Because
mm-hmm.
it cannot be sustained. That kind of
right.
thing that is a false value that will not sustain you through the whole of your life. You can convince yourself that it does, but it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, it's like your comment about worship wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What do you worship? How wise is your worship? And same thing what you just described, Andre, apply there too. You know, somebody worships power, worships wealth, and having lots of cool stuff. You know, that's
talent.
Where you're going to end up. Yeah, I mean, it could be anything. But
yeah,
we're urged to focus our worship on God, of course, because that's what brings the true riches of a fulfilled life and the potential to carry on into the next life. All those other lesser objects of worship tend not to do that.
Well, and the general litmus test for something being a false value as well is, why is it chosen? Why is that false value chosen? Generally, it's a false value that's chosen because of how it elevates that person by hanging on to that false value. And more to the point, how it elevates that person above their fellow persons versus faith in, you know, our Heavenly Father right-sizes us. Faith in our Heavenly Father tells us the value of love and shows us the value of service of our fellows, of being a man or a woman among men and women. And that's very different as a value and is functional and is true and can be lived out versus having to be top dog, having to be narcissistically loved by others above other people. You know, one promotes us and them, the other promotes we're, it's all us. We are all in this together.
Yeah, you know, this, I think Marvin before, Marvin had to jump off for a few minutes. He said he's coming back. But, you know, he mentioned how we oftentimes take the grand leader, the human. And it doesn't matter what human it is. I mean, we talked about how it could be in, you know, the head of a state. It could also be the head of religion, you know, the holiness or the, you know, the emperor, your majesty. You know, we humans have fallen into this trap of fetishizing other humans. And, you know, I said earlier, God alone is sovereign, and it's something that humanity has yet to learn. But, you know, I just want to go on a bit of a rant here, if you guys will indulge me, about one of our biggest false gods in perhaps in the whole of humanity, and that is these heroes that appear on the silver screen. It doesn't matter if it's a big silver screen or a little silver screen. You know, nonetheless, they appear to be heroes. And so this whole thing that everybody's buzzing about where Will, you know, Smith went and slapped Chris Rock's face in front of millions of people right before he received this great honor from his peers and colleagues that we know as Oscars, and a little statue that's highly coveted by these heroes of the silver screen. And, you know, lately, and I love a good movie as much as anybody, you know. Why? Because, you know, really good storytelling, and this is as old as time, can take you out of your own little self and your own little problems and let you forget for a moment as you get lost in kind of the tale of another, an epic tale perhaps. And some people are brilliant at telling the story. Many actors are gifted actors. There's no doubt about it. They have a talent. The same thing is true with music, right? Music takes us away, gets us out of our own little problems for a minute, you know. It can have so much meaning to us and value. It puts us in a beautiful space oftentimes, or makes us contemplative about something. You know, these things are important and they're worth, you know, noting. But our fascination with Hollywood and its fascination with itself has taken on unrealistic proportions now. And the fact that they spend so much time congratulating themselves and each other for their wonderful performances, and the fact that, you know, it's like, it's almost absurd. It's like, when do you guys stop patting yourself on the back for these wonderful performances? And when do we as a collective stop saying, you know what, it's great and all, but it really doesn't matter all that much? You know, it's not all that important. I'm glad you gave a great performance. That's wonderful. I appreciated it. I applauded, right? I put my money down to go and see it. It should end right there. But they don't let it end. They go on to these absurd levels of self-aggrandizement. That's all it really is. in its essence, it's self-aggrandizement. They can't get enough attention for their wonderful selves. And so I just have to get, thanks for letting me get that off my chest. Because more and more, as life goes on, I tend to not care about these award ceremonies and who's getting accolades for being the best singer or the best actor or whatever it is. You know, it just doesn't matter all that much. And reality, the reality of the spirit, the reality as we contemplate the reality of God and our creator. You know, these things become more and more ridiculous. I don't know if you've experienced that, you guys, or not. But
sure.
And maybe you wouldn't even bother to watch it. I've stopped watching it. But now, you know, all of the news is all about Will Smith slapping.
it's just about something else entirely. Anyway.
It's all about the slap.
There's an interesting comment in the book about this kind of thing. You know, and what you're saying applies to maybe celebrity in general. I mean, to put it so like sports figures and things. I mean, they're held up as, you know, heroic in many cases. Sometimes.
Yeah, sports figures are another
one. They're a good character, and that can be,
have
some legitimacy. But I wonder if I could just read this one paragraph because it
kind
of speaks to what you're talking about. I'm sure you're all familiar with this. But they say that, this is in paper 92, The Later Evolution of Religion. Section 5, paragraph 5, where they say, most great religious epics have been inaugurated by the life and teachings of some outstanding personality. Leadership has originated a majority of the worthwhile moral movements of history, and men have always tended to venerate the leader, even at the expense of his teachings, to revere his personality, even though losing sight of the truth which he proclaimed. And this is not without reason. There is an instinctive longing in the heart of evolutionary man for help from above and beyond. This craving is designed to anticipate the appearance on Earth of the planetary prince and the later material sons. On Urantia, man has been deprived of these superhuman leaders and rulers, and therefore does he constantly seek to make good this loss by enshrouding his human leaders with legends pertaining to supernatural origins and miraculous careers. So there's something in there, this longing for some miraculous hero to appear on the horizon and just fix everything and take care of it. You know what I mean? We want, and it's natural.
Kick butt and take names. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's been, you know, what are they, I mean, it's,
It's an instinctive
longing. They refer to it as an instinctive longing in the heart of evolutionary man for help from above and beyond. So
the fact that we're
deprived of that doesn't mean that that longing is going to go away. It's just going to be directed in
just the opposite. In a way, it's just the opposite, right? It becomes more pronounced, and it becomes more focused on one of my favorite quotes, and I've said it often on the show, is from Paper 88. It's about the fetish man, and it says, many people looked upon geniuses as fetish personalities possessed by a wise spirit, and these talented humans soon learned to resort to fraud and trickery for the advancement of their selfish interests. I think that's the danger. A fetish man was thought to be more than human. He was divine, even infallible. Thus did chiefs, kings, priests, prophets, and church rulers, and I'll say actors, and musicians, and sports heroes, eventually wield great power and exercise unbounded authority. So, it's in us. It is something we should be cognizant of and mindful of.
Well, you know, that's one of the
Can you guys hear me?
Can I just throw in this one thought?
Hear you, Marvin.
Excuse me, Marvin.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add to what Paula was saying, that what we have in the Urantia book with the story of Jesus gives us a real hero that we can look to. Even though he's not resident on the planet, he can still fulfill the longing they're talking about. And I think maybe we've all experienced that. I know I have. I was thinking to myself one day, okay, who's my leader? Who would I look up to more than anyone else? And, of course, it's Jesus, right? But I only got to that place by learning about him through the Erasure book. So the Erasure book sort of brings him alive in our lives. So he is
without a doubt,
literally, you know, like they say,
the hero of all
spirit.
Heroes. We don't need to make up Superman. He Superman lived on this world. We don't need to make up
anyway,
a character. I love
that,
Chuck. Thank you.
So the other, give me just one sec here. The other interesting thing to think about when we're talking about this tendency to venerate human leaders, you know, in the for lack of a better term, what I'll call the anthropological papers in the Urantia book, you know, the ones that precede the religion papers where they talk about the ghost cults and the, you know, the all of that primitive human religion. One of the things they say that was a key stage and still is part of our temperament is the tendency to deify and venerate human leaders, to make human leaders our gods.
Mm-hmm.
And you have that actually shows up in our history many, many places. You know, from the Roman emperor worship, who was considered a semi-deity. And in many respects, you've had these human rulers who were deified, some of the Egyptian rulers, even all the way, you know, in the Second World War, Shinto, which was emperor worship, you know, was a part of what fueled the Japanese involvement in the Second World War. And so here's a question, and actually I think the most pointed expressions of that tendency to deify and worship human leaders is actually in the atheistic systems, in the Marxist expression in Russia and in China, with some of the great leaders who are really venerated almost as spiritual figures. They're given almost superhuman kinds of, accorded superhuman kinds of powers. And if you think about it, what the Marxist-Leninist system, I mean, it's enlightened in a number of ways. But in essence, it is a Luciferian philosophy, but very pointedly. It asserts dramatically that there is no higher reality than human power and human nature. There is no God. And so, you know, power flows to the human leader to an inordinate degree because there's no superordinate authority. There's no higher sovereignty, as the book talks about. And so, what do you guys think about that, that those are, in a sense, Luciferian-based philosophical systems that that position human leaders in a semi-deity kind of position? And that makes sense to me with some of what's going on these days with Putin and even with Xi and what you think of some of the great leaders historically.
North Korea.
Yeah, North Korea is another really good example.
Yeah.
But you look at China and the history, it's almost like a religious fervor around people like Mao Zedong, who was the founder of Chinese Marxism, and Deng Xiaoping, and then more currently Xi. And so, you know, you just, because there's no God present, there's a tendency to venerate human figures as semi-deities.
It seems like we've gone through that forever to me. And it seems like it's taken different, you know, the monarchy is a good example. It's taken different, you know, faces, totalitarian religion, the Pope, you know, it was a time when the Holy Father in Rome was the most powerful being on the planet, considered more than human, you know. I mean, it's been going on for a long, long time. And I think here we go. Here's the Urantia book bringing us this concept of personal faith, the religion of personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
That you can have a relationship with divinity within yourself, in your own heart. And it's built up as an eternal endowment, as Jesus said to the apostles, you know, in the second discourse. You know, this is in yourself, of yourself, for yourself. This is your real power. This is who you are. You don't need to give this away to any so-called leader. This is in you. And you have this. It's yours, a divine gift. It's yours for the taking. And so often we give it away, right? We give our power to decide and our power to choose away to some authority person who seems to be way smarter than we are, you know, about such things.
Perfect example.
Yeah. And we give our discerning ability away. It's like my dear friend Chris Riggio once told me, every human being needs to listen to the inner broadcast first before any outer, before processing any outer information. And that's so true. That's what the book is here to tell us. God is in you. You are powerful. That's what Jesus was saying, right? And probably what troubled the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sanhedrin so much was Jesus was here to empower the individual. And the Urantia book is here to do the same thing.
Vern used to have this funny saying, they were thinking of putting on a bumper sticker, avoid costly middlemen, deal directly with God.
Own your own soul, as Errol Strider would say. Own your own soul.
Yeah, right.
You can own your own soul.
Yeah.
But what were you going to say, Chuck?
Oh, just this next section coming up maybe has some relevance to what you're saying.
Well, we can read it. I mean,
morality.
We probably won't have a chance to discuss it fully, but we can certainly do that next week, too. So I'm totally up for that, if you guys are.
Yeah.
Chuck, do you want to read that?
Sure.
Okay. Okay, well, I think it's interesting how it follows from the section we just read, which is about faith and belief.
Right.
Now they're going to carry that forward into a section here about religion and morality. Which I think is always very relevant, trying to understand how morality fits into the picture of spirit and having a religious life and a relationship with God and all that. Anyway, they say, let me just take a sip of water, sorry. No professed revelation of religion could be regarded as authentic if it failed to recognize the duty demands of ethical obligation, which had been created and fostered by preceding evolutionary religion. Revelation unfailingly enlarges the ethical horizon of evolved religion, while it simultaneously and unfailingly expands the moral obligations of all prior revelations. Mm-hmm. So they're talking about prior religions and prior revelations. When you presume to sit in critical judgment on the primitive religion of man or on the religion of primitive man, you should remember to judge such savages and to evaluate their religious experience in accordance with their enlightenment and status of conscience. Do not make the mistake of judging another's religion by your own standards of knowledge and truth. True religion is that sublime and profound conviction within the soul, which compellingly admonishes man that it would be wrong for him not to believe in those morontial realities which constitute his highest ethical and moral concepts, his highest interpretation of life's greatest values and the universe's deepest realities. And such a religion is simply the experience of yielding intellectual loyalty to the highest dictates of spiritual consciousness. It's a really interesting sentence. The search for beauty is a part of religion only insofar as it is ethical and to the extent that it enriches the concept of the moral. Art is only religious when it becomes diffused with and derived from high spiritual motivation. The enlightened spiritual consciousness of civilized man is not concerned so much with some specific intellectual belief or with any one particular mode of living as with discovering the truth of living, the good and right technique of reacting to the ever-recurring situations of mortal existence. Moral consciousness is just the name applied to the human recognition and awareness of those ethical and emerging moral values, which duty demands that man shall abide by in the day-by-day control and guidance of conduct. Interesting, control and guidance of conduct. Though recognizing that religion is imperfect, there are at least two practical manifestations of its nature and function. One, the spiritual urge and philosophic pressure of religion tend to cause man to project his estimation of moral values directly outward into the affairs of his fellows, the ethical reaction of religion. And two, religion creates for the human mind a spiritualized consciousness of divine reality based on and by faith derived from antecedent concepts of moral values and coordinated with superimposed concepts of spiritual values. Religion thereby becomes a censor of mortal affairs, a form of glorified moral trust and confidence in reality, the enhanced realities of time and the more enduring realities of eternity. Faith becomes the connection between moral consciousness and the spiritual concept of enduring reality. Religion becomes the avenue of man's escape from the material limitations of the temporal and natural world to the supernal realities of the eternal and spiritual world by and through the technique of salvation, progressive Marantia transformation. Wow, that's an echo back to those seven types of salvation that we were just reading about while you were gone, Paula.
Yeah.
But here they refer to salvation as a progressive Marantia transformation. I think that's a very cool way of thinking about that.
Don't you think that this whole concept is just vitally important? Vitally important. I guess the part that I hone in on most is their understanding of humanity. This just touches my heart. Whenever I contemplate the authors of the Urantia book, whenever I contemplate Jesus, whenever I contemplate the angels, whenever I contemplate God the Father, you know, and the loving universe that we live in, that we're a part of, whether we know it or not, you know, their patience with humans where they are, and their admonition not to judge them where they are, because they are where they are. And as they look at us, they see us and they say, well, here they are in this stage of their evolution. This is who they are. We can't expect more than that from them. You know, a pint can't hold a quart, right? They say it in so many ways. If Jesus had been indignant about humanity where it was, he never would have come here. But he wasn't indignant about it. He came and lived a life as a man in his time and day. And he showed a higher way of living, a higher mode of living. And it eventually got him killed. But he didn't, his last act on earth was to say, forgive them, Father, for they know not what they do. He knew it. They all do. They don't hold it against us if we're not capable of understanding these higher concepts. We are where we are. You know, our worship of other humans, that's a stage that we had to go through. And maybe what we're seeing is the last gasps of monarchies and dictatorial rulers as they exit the stage of reality because they're, you know, they don't deserve what we're willingly giving them, and we need to focus our attention somewhere else.
Well, we
need good leaders.
You know,
we need
the
leaders.
We do. Yeah, we just don't worship them. We shouldn't worship them.
Right.
Well,
right.
I think what it is, it's a matter of proportional relationships. right? In other words, and that's why the Urmia lectures, for instance, when they talk about religious sovereignty and then political sovereignty, make such a big deal about what they call super sovereignty. In other words, you know, if we hold high to the ideal that there is a highest person that we have ultimate loyalty to, and that's not a human figure, that's a spiritual figure, and whether it's couched as the universal father or as Jesus, it's a deity, a true deity figure that we have a relationship with. When we do that, we hold our human leaders in a different light, proportionally. We don't accord them right. those deity prerogatives. And that makes a huge difference in the way we function and structurally. And so I think, you know, that's a big part of it. And also, obviously, the reestablishment of the communication circuits. And eventually, what I think we all hope for is the revisiting on the planet of these revelatory beings, you know, like Adam and Eve and Melchizedek and teacher sons and teacher Adamal sons but you know, for us to have had Adam and Eve here and here permanently and to have a planetary prince, a legitimate planetary prince, would have satisfied that longing for quasi-human leadership.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah, in a huge way, and with integrity. I don't think we're going to get the full rectification of our problems until there's some kind of reestablishment of celestial human partnership on the planet that we can see, that we can relate to directly. That will rectify, I think, a lot of things.
Well, we're kind of encouraged to try to become that ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, to live, you know, when they talk about Jesus being alive within us.
Yeah.
That there is that potential somehow.
Yeah. See Jesus living again. Yeah.
Yeah, that whole idea. That's we shouldn't discount the importance of that.
That's
because that is a real living presence within each of us that can have an influence. Yeah.
Maybe that's a good point. And you know, there were two things that struck me in this last section. I'm sorry, did someone else want to say something?
Oh, I was just going to comment about something else in this section too, but go ahead.
Yeah. So this is in the one we just read, section 5, the fifth paragraph. I thought that was really interesting. The enlightened spiritual consciousness of civilized man is not concerned so much with some specific intellectual belief or with any one particular mode of living as with discovering the truth of living. And then they parenthetically unpack that. The good and right technique of reacting to the ever-recurring situations of mortal existence. So, you know, there is this question that comes up because they task us with developing a spiritual symbolic culture for our day and age and for the upcoming generations. And they task us with spreading that new religious perspective, spiritual perspective or culture to the broader culture, the global culture. They say, you know, you have to be busy with that task. So there is the question of how do we communicate this thing that they're trying to get at in this sentence, that it's not a particular intellectual idea, but it's a good and right technique of reacting to the ever-recurring situations of mortal existence, which largely have to do with our relationships and interactions with each other, ethically, morally, and the cultures that we build together sociologically. So, and that's why, for me, the most powerful way, I mean, we all search for ways to express this, right, what the heart of the gospel is. And for me, the most helpful way, and it's for me stood the test of several decades of conceptualizing and using it, is a way of life in the family of God. That what the gospel is about is a living set of spiritual family relationships, parent-child with God and sister-brother with each other. And when we use that as an experiential guideline, it's so sophisticated and so endless in its application that it provides what they describe here, a good and right technique of reacting to the ever-recurring situations of mortal existence. It shows us the way to do those in a higher spiritual sense and in interaction with the indwelling spirit and the spirit of truth and our angelic companions, all of it. All of that is kind of well encapsulated by that catchphrase.
Well, I think it's kind of a follow-up on that. I think it's really interesting how they phrase this sentence. That was the same sentence I was looking at, the first sentence of the fifth paragraph, where they say that the enlightened spiritual consciousness, they don't say that it's concerned with the truth of living. They say it's about discovering the truth of living. Implies that that's an ongoing journey of discovery. That enlightened spiritual consciousness, if I can just take out those two phrases in the middle, is concerned with discovering the truth of living and then the good and right technique of reacting and all of that. But I like the idea that every day we can discover more about the truth of living. And I'm just wondering what you guys think they mean by that. But the truth of living, in terms of discovery, implies almost kind of like a trial and error learning process where we screw up some days and we don't treat people right or we do something that causes a bad outcome even though we didn't intend it. You know, there's some thing mixed up in there that we didn't quite understand or have mastered or whatever it might be. And then there's a discovery, you know, an aha moment where, that, I know why I said that. I shouldn't have said that or whatever it might be. But if you know what I mean. But there's a process of discovery, which is tied in with self-mastery, I think, also, where we get better at living. And we make fewer, you know, like at least dumb mistakes. But it has to do with discovering this goodness and this righteousness, the possibility of goodness and righteousness in our reaction to ever-recurring situations. And that's all kinds of things are wrapped up in that.
Yeah. A lot of this has to do with the courage of one's convictions, right? So that, you know, the truth of living is being willing to live up to the courage of your own convictions. And that's the overall arcing theme of this section for me is that, you know, we all have different starting points. But we have to be true to what we know, what we believe is true. And it takes a lot of courage to do that sometimes. It takes a lot of courage to live up to what you believe is true and what you in your heart of hearts know, you know, or feel keenly is true. And, you know, even if that's relative, even if that's, you know, you're a primitive person and you're living a primitive religion where you believe God is a punisher, you know, and you believe, you know, many things that, you know, an enlightened person would say, no, those things aren't true about God. But you're living up to that inner conviction that what you know is true. And it's relative to who you are and where you are in that moment of time. And if that's the best you can do, then that's the best you can do. And, you know, not to judge. They're telling us don't judge that. That's true religion, and it's a sublime and profound conviction within the soul which compellingly admonishes man that it would be wrong for him not to believe in those moral realities which constitute his highest ethical and moral concepts, his highest interpretation of life's greatest values and the universe's deepest realities. And such a religion is simply the experience of yielding intellectual loyalty to the highest dictates of spiritual consciousness. And so for us, for all of us who have been given this knowledge and who say we believe it, you know, we're going to be held to a higher standard, I think.
Well, something to grow into. It's good to have that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
And even if it's only if we hold ourselves to that higher standard.
Uh-huh. Right.
Go ahead, Martin.
Right.
Sorry.
Yeah. Oh, there's, you know, the themes that you and Chuck are weaving out here really tie together beautifully. And in particular, Chuck, when you're saying it's an ongoing experience, yeah, to put it mildly, because that continual experience the destiny of it is all the way through the age of the supreme, through the age of the ultimate, to eventually the age of the absolute. You know, the experiential unfoldment of our discovery of relationship with the indwelling spirit of God, it's never ending. It's an eternal unfolding. So, you know, there's no end point to that growth that we can conceive of.
Right, exactly.
Which is great.
And
you know,
someday we'll look back on who we are right now in this moment, and laugh about the things that, you know, we thought. Because we will have gone so far beyond even those things.
Well, we look back on our own adolescence, our own childhood, you know, and just chuckle at where we were, you know.
Andre mentioned earlier about a dear friend. She fully, you know, she was engaged in a religion that fully believed that if you sipped from that cup, you were outing yourself as one of the elect, one of the chosen. What a horrible place to put a person in. What a difficult decision. Yet she's moved completely beyond that. And now she can look back at that belief and see it for what it is, you know. She doesn't even have to judge it. She's just moved beyond it. She's, you know, we rise like cream in that way. We rise to a higher understanding and more faith and compassion and morality and, you know, what was commonly practiced by one group 100 years ago is not at all what's practiced now. And it's just these changes take time, especially with groups. Especially with religion.
Yeah, well, and individuals too. This paragraph too, when you talk about, you know, warnings about presuming to sit in judgment on other people's beliefs and religious convictions, reminds me of what Jesus would say about how, you know, when he was instructing the apostles to not take anything away. Like their job is not to try to kill what somebody else already believes, you know. Their job is to add to what they already know and understand, and you know, in a spirit of kindness and so forth, rather than just going around attacking, you know, the existing beliefs that people have. Yeah, just leave that alone. Let that be, because that's what's got them to where they are, you're even having this conversation. You wouldn't be having this conversation with that person if it wasn't for all the steps they had to take to get to that place where they're now maybe open to hearing something new and higher, a higher understanding. So to honor even these sometimes just crazy things, what might appear to be a crazy belief, nonetheless, that's brought them to where they are. So we have to kind of honor that and not be cruel or mean or create resentments or, you know, all the things that will then poison their ability to hear what
demonize.
They contribute.
Yeah, you just want to always be on the positive side.
Serves
as scaffolding,
Right. You know, be sensitive to that.
Before we end off, I wanted the last paragraph of the section was also very interesting, paragraph 9. A couple of interesting things there. One, it says, faith becomes the connection between two things, moral consciousness, the sense of right and wrong, that you know, and the spiritual concept of enduring reality, what is real. And that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. That faith mm-hmm. connects up our sense of right and wrong to our sense of what is real. And then they say, in the way they sort of tie a bow on this thing about salvation, religion becomes the avenue of man's escape from the material limitations of the temporal and natural world to the supernal realities of the eternal and spiritual world by and through the technique of salvation, comma, the progressive Maranja transformation, which is really an interesting capper to what they mean by the technique of salvation. So there's
a growing
change.
Soul.
Well, yeah, the progressive Maranta transformation means it's inseparable. You know, we've talked about this. It's inseparable from living experience, relationships, choices, unfolding in the ethical, on the ethical stage, and discovering more of spirit reality. We're doing this day in and day out, and that's this emerging Maranta birth or transformation, and that provides, and through faith, that and with Jesus' help, angelic help, the Father's help, Mother Supreme's help, all of it, and through that avenue we're gaining salvation that takes us, and the phrasing is really, really interesting, helps us escape from the material limitations of the temporal and natural world to the supernal realities of the eternal and spiritual world. So that's, wow, that's just a gorgeous description of so much in that one paragraph.
Yeah, it's truly amazing. And I would love to hear, you know, what Andre, you know, some of your thoughts, Andre, because you've been really quiet while Marvin and Chuck and I have been going on and on. I know you've been percolating some thoughts. What do you think, Andre?
I know this is revelatory, but you'd never believe that a webcast is a finite medium and that there is only so much that can be said within that finite medium. Well, you know, it's been a wonderful conversation to follow, and that last paragraph is very interesting too. I'm trying to see what really strikes me, but I guess what strikes me most was what was shared earlier about, you know, the nature of living truth. I think Chuck was alluding to that, and then that really does still pertain to this idea of faith becoming a connection between moral consciousness and the spiritual concept of enduring reality. The idea of living truth is the idea of living in reality. It's living what is livable, as contrasted with what you cannot live and have a sustainable life. You know, and we're seeing examples of that all over the world, where one group oppresses another. That's not sustainable. That's not living truth at all in any regard. On the other hand, you have wherever people are living the gospel, that is living reality. That is truth. Why is it truth? You know, it was helpful as a growing reader in the teachings of the Urantia book to at some point come up with my own, you know, distillations of what was meant by things like that. And so there were two things that came about. For one thing, quick and dirty definition of truth for me was what works. What works when I live? If it doesn't work, it's not truth. If I can't really live it and keep living it, it really isn't truth. You know, I had to flesh that out a bit more. And at some point it became clear that it was a synthesis of not only what is workable and real, but it was real both in its idealism and its pragmatism. It had something that could work pragmatically, but wasn't devoid of ideals. So think, you know, oppressive totalitarian kinds of things. Some of those things are very pragmatic and very deadly and destructive and not where we want to go. And think of idealism. Wonderful precepts of what could work, but that do not have a foundation in reality that can develop either roots or traction or get people to want to do it because it doesn't relate to their lives as they find it. So if we can find those kinds of things through our faith, and what is faith again? It's a quick and dirty definition is acting as though something is real.
You know, if I have faith in the almighty dollar, I will get some corroboration about that, but it doesn't last. There are a lot of dissatisfying things in the inner life. If I act as though God is my loving father and that therefore all men and women are my brothers and sisters, that can be corroborated even if I'm not fully up to the task, even if I don't yet love every person. It can challenge me in my inner life in a positive way to want to do that, to want to live not every person necessarily, but that next person, one more person every week or every day or however that works. That's livable reality, and it's progressively livable, and it's livable on higher and higher levels.
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah, I like that a lot, Andre. I think you're right on target. And a real helpful insight for me in terms of trying to understand what I mean by this word Marantia is that Marantia is, you know, sort of in my little human puny mind, Marantia equals lived experiential reality equals truth. In other words, it's not a Marantia reality unless it can be lived out, and truth doesn't exist unless it can be lived out in relationships and in our day-to-day experience. If you're not dealing with lived-out truth, you're dealing with concept or ideation, right? And there's a real distinction between a mind reality and a personality reality and a Marantia reality. So what you're saying is beautifully explicative of a lot of that same set of principles, which is very important. You know, it's not just, as Jesus tried to reiterate, it's not just a way of believing something. It's a way of living our lives in our relationships with God and with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow, beautiful, you guys.
You know, and sometimes
what a great conversation.
Sometimes that truth of living lands you up in a wonderful Indian restaurant together. Isn't that great?
That was a treat.
Wednesday evening was leftovers, and I was just reflecting on the wonderful experience we shared. Go ahead, Paula. You were going to describe it.
No, I was just going to say, Marvin, I hope it's okay to say that you had a big journey. You went to Chicago and picked up your Tesla, and you got to drive it back home to Nevada. And on the way, he stopped in Colorado, and Chuck and Derek and me and Andre and Crystalline. It's the old cosmic crew, really, and Crystalline's husband, and then members of the board of the Urantia University Institute, Ari and Carmen Horn, who are Merritt Horn's daughters, all came, and also Jeanette McCain, and we had a wonderful meal together. It was just sublime.
And
you should know that. Go ahead.
I say Andre and I stayed up till 2 a.m. discussing anything and everything related to the
pretty
world
much.
And the revelation. Go ahead, Paula. Go ahead.
Well, we had a chuckle earlier because Marvin was concerned that, you know, the noise in the restaurant would preclude us from being able to have a meaningful conversation, and we chuckled because we realized we were the noise in the restaurant. We were the most disruptive thing they probably had in a long time. And it's classic Urantia party where, you know, it just is a dull roar of conversation. And, it's always a blast.
Well, that's it. It's sort of indicative of how much fun. I mean, we so much enjoy each other's company. And it's probably, appropriate to make a plug for the Fellowship Summer Conference, you know, where after almost 3 years of community isolation, we're going to get together again and be together as a community. So that's very exciting, very much looking forward to those opportunities.
Yeah, I hope to see everyone there. That would be wonderful. I'm planning to go, so yay. And I'm going as not the director, but just an attendee. That's going to be really
be nice.
Fun for me, I got to tell you. So anyway, well, thanks, you guys. It was really wonderful again, as always. And we'll be back next week. I guess we'll finish this paper out. We might as well. It's you know, the last section, religion is man's liberator. So, or maybe that's the second to the last. No, it is the last. Yay. Okay. We'll do that one.
All right, everyone.
Right? All right, my friends. Well, God bless. Till next time.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Until next time.
Lots of love to all of you.
You too.
Yeah. Love to you too. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
Much love. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.